Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
It's great to be here and a real honor to present in front of this great audience. So the title of my talk today is Bioengineering a Kidney Chip for Better, Safer, and Faster Drug Development. And this is a bit of a riff on the Olympic motto, which we're in the middle of right now, which is stronger, higher, faster. We're going better, safer, and faster for drug development. The kidney is sometimes an overlooked organ. Despite that, and this is despite the fact that up to 12 to 15% of adults in the world are affected by kidney disease. The tricky thing about kidney disease is that by the time you recognize that the kidneys are malfunctioning and you see an abnormal test result, most of the kidney function is already lost, and that's irreversible. So those tests don't show up as abnormal until about 50% of kidney function is lost. So we really need to figure out a way to intercept the decline in kidney function at earlier stages. We also know that in some cases, kidney disease is associated with comorbid conditions, including diabetes and high blood pressure. But importantly, and this is from a patient care perspective, we have to recognize that people who get kidney disease shouldn't necessarily, sometimes we tend to judge them in a clinical perspective and we go, if you had taken better care of your blood pressure or your diabetes, you wouldn't have this kidney disease. And that's not a fair thing to do to our patients. What I do want to point out is a lot of kidney disease comes from unknown sources. So if we have any clinicians, please be mindful when you speak to your patients with kidney disease, and we need to treat the patient where they are. So let's back up and talk about kidneys and what they do. Normally we think about kidneys as making urine, and we think about that because we are reminded of that several times a day. But the kidney has a number of very critical functions, and those include acid-base balance, water and hydration balance, electrolytes, toxin and drug removal, control of blood pressure, synthesis of erythropoietin. And again, we're talking about that a lot in the Olympics. Erythropoietin is what athletes will use when they do doping for endurance events. And kidneys are also critical for the bioactivation of vitamin D. Vitamin D is stored in the liver in its inactive form, and then it's recruited out of the liver and activated in the kidney. So without that kidney function, you can't create that vitamin D that goes on to maintain your bone health and your immunologic function and all of these critical things that vitamin D does. And you'll notice in the highlighted, the bolded letters, this is what we teach the medical students about kidney function. If you notice, it spells a wet bed. So if you want to know what kidneys do, that's how you know what they do. So with chronic kidney disease specifically, this disease can take months or years to develop. So somebody may start to develop kidney disease in their 20s or 30s. It may not manifest until they're in their 50s or 60s. So this is a very difficult disease to study. Conventional methods for studying kidney disease include things like rat and mouse models, typically a 5-6 nephrectomy model. And that's when you take an otherwise healthy rodent, you do a little surgery, you take out one whole kidney and 2/3 of the remaining kidney. And that's called a 5-6 nephrectomy model, and that puts that animal immediately into severe kidney disease. This neglects the fact that when people get kidney disease that develops over decades, their bodies have time to adapt, and their kidneys have time to adapt, so they don't get thrown into chronic kidney disease immediately. It's a very progressive process. So animal models are very useful in some settings, but in the study of chronic kidney disease, they lack some of the nuance. The other way that kidney disease is studied is with cell models. And these are typically cells that are grown in plates or dishes in a monolayer. These cells will last about a week, and without that constant flow that the kidneys experience, the cells don't really know which aspect of the cell is considered inside of the body and which side of the cell is considered outside of the body, so the transporters don't polarize correctly for some of these cell models. Again, they can be very useful. But in some circumstances, we don't get quite as much information as we would like. So about 10 or 12 years ago, our team at the University of Washington decided that we would try to develop a new kidney model based on this new technology of microphysiological systems, or MPS. And these MPSs have some interesting characteristics. For one, you can grow cells in a tubular scaffold. And with that tubular scaffold, you can maintain physiologic flow through the lumen of that tubule. And that physiological flow causes the transporters in those tubules to polarize correctly. And because we have these correctly polarized transporters, we can start doing toxicology studies or drug transport studies. Again, if we look at a kidney, so this is a kidney. Again, you have two of them, most of you. They're about the size of your fists. They live in the back of your body. If you were born with one kidney or you have donated a kidney, you have one. If you have had a transplant, you have three or four. Depending on how many transplants you've had, they take that new organ and they stick it in the front of your body where the plumbing is more convenient. And the functional unit of that kidney is called the nephron. And each of your kidneys has about a million nephrons if you have a healthy kidney. And the kidney is made up of these tubular, this is a tubule with different segments. And each of those segments has a distinct function. And so we focused our MPS on the proximal tubule, which is just the segment adjacent to the glomerulus. And this proximal tubule is my favorite because it does a lot of the drug handling functions. So it takes the drugs that are in your body that are renally cleared and moves them out of your blood and into your urine at the same time exposing themselves to all of these drugs and toxins. So they are also highly susceptible to toxicity. So if you have a drug-associated acute kidney injury, many times that occurs within this proximal tubule segment. So we took cells from a kidney in the proximal tubules, and so we use primary cells. We don't use immortalized cells or stem cell-derived cells. We take primary cells from human kidneys, extract them out of the kidney, and then grow them in what we call our kidney on a chip. And you look at it, there's little knobs on the front. Those help to control the flow. But if you look at it from the back, what you'll see is you'll see the blue line is the flow path. You have an inlet where we push media in, and then we have those bubble traps. If you do microfluidics, you know that bubbles are your enemy. So we have some bubble traps. And then the flow path continues into this pink chamber, and that's the cell culture chamber. And if you look from the back, you can see a very, very fine blue line. And that's where we grow our proximal tubule cells. There's about 5,000 to 10,000 cells in that tubule, so our analytics have to be extremely sensitive. But this is how we grow our cells. We grow them under a roughly physiological flow rate, and then because the flow path goes all the way through, we can then collect what comes out of the chip, which is sort of the proto-urine. So we can do toxicology studies and look at effluent biomarkers. So our goal for our first set of grants was to look at cell viability after 4 weeks. That was what NIH asked us to do. So what we did was we waited for 4 weeks, and then we did some live dead staining, and the green cells indicate the live cells, and the red spots are cells that are dead. This is a live dead stain. We did note that we could keep these cells growing for 4 weeks, and in fact, one of our grad students went on vacation. Left these cells growing in the incubator, and we found out that we could actually get these cells to grow for 2 months instead of just 1 month. So we exceeded our expectations for viability, which was great. Now, the kidney is made up of some, depending on who you ask, 30 to 40 to 50 different cell types. And we are trying to get one cell type to grow in our device. So how do we know that we have the right cells in our device? So we had to stain for markers of kidney epithelium, and those were CD13, E-cadherin, and aquaporin 1, and in blue are the nuclei, and in red, or sorry, blue are the nuclei, and red is the staining for our protein of interest. We also wanted to make sure that these tubules were correctly polarized. We wanted to make sure that the tube was constructed so that what was inside of that tube was where the urine would be, and what's outside of that tubule would be where the blood would be. And you can see why this is a very important characteristic, both in your body and in a device that's used to study the kidney. So we stained for proteins that either localized to the inside or the outside of the kidney tubule, and those were ZO1 and sodium potassium ATPase. And ZO1 forms on the interior aspect of the tubule, which we see in the green, and sodium potassium ATPase forms in the basolateral aspect of the tubule, which is the outside blood facing and in between those cells. So we were able to see that we had both ZO1 and sodium potassium ATPase correct in the correct orientations. We also looked for some unique cell structure. And kidney proximal tubule cells have these specialized structures called monocilia. And it's one cilia that sticks out of the cell like the horn of a unicorn, and it kind of hangs out in the flow path where the urine is. And this monocilia is a sensing organ. It can tell the cell about electrolytes. It can tell the cell about flow. It can tell the cell about osmolality. So we wanted to make sure that our cells had this monocilia. And while every cell did not have a monocilia, some of them did. And that's this little red structure that I'm showing you. So some of our cells had that monocilia, suggesting to us that we had the right kind of cell, they were in the right orientation, and they were developing physical characteristics of a proximal tubule epithelial cell. So now that we have kidney cells and they grow on a chip, what can we do with it? So I'm going to present to you three projects today that we've used our MPS to try and understand kidney physiology, toxicology, and drug exposure. So the first project I'm going to talk to you today about is using a multi-organ MPS to understand nephrotoxicity. And this is when we took our kidney MPS, which we had already established did normal kidney functions, and we connected it to a liver MPS. So we had liver preceding kidney, as you would experience in the human body. And then we used that to understand something called bioactivation. So we used this tool or set of tools to understand the mechanism of aristolochic acid nephrotoxicity. And this is a disease that was observed in the 60s or 70s in a group of young women who were taking herbal diet supplements. And many of these women, I think 80 of these women, in the early 90s in Belgium, were diagnosed with advanced kidney injury. These are healthy people. You wouldn't expect them to have any sort of major kidney dysfunction, but they had received a slimming tea from a Chinese herbal physician. And the causative agent was determined to be aristolochic acid. And this was from the aristolochia plant, which had contaminated some of the other herbal components. This is also seen in the Balkans, where this aristolochic acid plant can be endemic and can grow within the wheat fields. So when that wheat is harvested, sometimes it harvests some of this aristolochia as well. And when that wheat is ground into flour, that flour is now contaminated. That contaminated flour can be baked into bread and cause these long-term exposures in some of these Balkan states. And in these Balkan states, there's also an extremely high incidence of chronic kidney disease. So there is something going on with this aristolochia plant that results in kidney injury. But if you take that aristolochia plant and you grind it up and you take an ethanol extract or some sort of extract and you put it into kidney cells, the kidney cells are fine. So it's not the aristolochic acid in the plant itself that's causing this kidney injury. So we thought that there was something going on, possibly bioactivation. And bioactivation is a common thing we see in pharmacy. Some of our drugs are what we call prodrugs. The drug we administer is not in itself active, but when it goes through the liver, it's metabolized into an active form. And some of these prodrugs that we use all the time are aspirin. Aspirin is a prodrug, codeine is a prodrug, tamoxifen is a prodrug, clopidogrel, which is an anticoagulant, is also a prodrug. Also loratadine, if you have allergies, you may have loratadine in your medicine cabinet. That's a prodrug as well. So we know that this occurs, that the liver can bioactivate compounds. Typically, we think that the liver is going to make a compound less toxic, but it can also make a compound more toxic. So here's what we did. We took some hepatocytes, we grew them on a chip, and we connected it to a kidney on a chip. And when I say we, I mean it was a graduate student. And she got really tired of hearing us talk about, can we hook a liver chip to a kidney chip? What media would we use? What flow rate would we use? And we thought about this a lot, and she got sick of hearing us talk about it. And so she went to the lab, hooked a liver chip to a kidney chip, mixed the medias 50-50, and started the flow. So here's what we saw. So on the left set of panels, we have kidney-only cells. So we didn't hook it up to a liver. And in the right set of panels, we have that liver chip hooked into the kidney chip. And on the top is our controls, where we infused no aristolochic acid. And then we did a couple doses, 10 micromolar and 25 micromolar aristolochic acid. And as we expected, with the kidney cells alone, we saw predominantly live cells. Again, the green cells are alive, red cells are dead. The cells did not seem particularly affected by this aristolochic acid when it was just the kidney. But when we ran it through the hepatocytes before we put it into the kidney, again, our control cells were pretty happy. And as we started to increase the dose, we started to see a lot of these cells that were dying. And in fact, by the time we got to 25 micromolar, the only cells we could see were dead, and we didn't see a lot of them because the cells were so dead that they had sloughed off of the tubule and been flushed into the effluent. So at 25 micromolar, this was an extremely toxic metabolite that had come out of the liver. So now we're starting to unravel this mystery about why aristolochic acid causes kidney disease. We did some more investigation to try and understand exactly the mechanisms of toxicity. So we looked at how those toxic compounds might be entering into the kidney. So we looked at OAT1 and OAT3 transporter-mediated toxicity, and OAT1 and OAT3 are some of the primary transporters that are involved in the kidney, in the proximal tubule, that take compounds from the blood and move them into the cell of the proximal epithelium. And what we saw, again, when we looked at our controls and our treatment, plus or minus probenecid, which is an inhibitor of this transport, we saw a lot of cell death when we did not have the inhibitor. Once we inhibited the transport of those toxic compounds into the proximal tubule cells, our cell death was much lower. So based on these studies, we could say convincingly that whatever was happening in the liver was creating some sort of metabolite that was circulating and then being taken up into the kidney proximal tubule cells, where it was becoming a toxic agent. Now, we knew that aristolochic acid could also maybe toxic by forming adducts within the cell. So we then looked at adduct formation by this aristolochic metabolite. Again, when we looked at the kidney, you're looking for pink or red. That's what's staining for that aristolochic acid adduct. When we just have the kidney, again, a couple cells, not real happy, but for the most part, okay. When we ran that through the liver and the kidney, we start to see this adduction in the kidney cells. So we were able to understand that something, that there is oxidative metabolism in the liver, it's transported to the kidney where it's taken up into the cell by OAT1 and 3, where it forms these adducts, which leads to cell death. So here's how we kind of deconvoluted this whole mystery. We know that aristolochic acid is metabolized in the liver by two different enzymes, NQO1 and sulfotransferases. It's released from the kidney by MRP transporters. It's taken up into the, it's released from the liver by MRP transporters. It's taken up into the kidney by OAT transporters, where it causes adducts and ultimately causes nephrotoxicity. So this is actually pretty cool, right? We can use this tool to deconvolute mechanisms of toxicity. We can also use it to predict toxicity in drugs that are undergoing investigational study. So, you know, this is a good proof of concept and also a good way for us to use tools to study different things. And, you know, I will say that the kidney chip is just a tool, right? We can use it for a whole lot of different things. And I think it's great if we can allow other people to use these tools, because they will come up with creative uses that we haven't figured out yet. So the next project I want to talk to you about is using kidney MPS as a tool to populate physiologically based pharmacokinetic models and to predict human renal clearance. So now we're moving into using this chip as an in vitro tool to study mechanisms of toxicity, to using this tool to predict drug exposure in human beings. So with this project, our workflow will be to take our kidney on a chip, we'll scale that kidney on a chip to human renal clearance, and then we'll use that human renal clearance value to populate a whole body pharmacokinetic model so that we can look at drug exposure dynamically and not just at a single point in time. So this required some evolution of our kidney on a chip. Our beta version, which you see on the left, was about the size of a quarter, had none of those little knobs and buttons. It had one tube that went down the middle. It was great, but it was hard to use. The next iteration had those same bubble traps and knobs and still had one tubule that went down the middle. The next iteration had two channels, and this is what we call the dual channel chip. And that's when we take two tubules and we put them right next to each other. Right, so one tube can be our blood flow, and the adjacent tube will be our proximal tubule. So now we're starting to get into a very complex model that involves a compound being infused into the blood side that compound getting out of the blood vessel, having it move through that interstitial space where it's taken up by one of these transporters like O1 or O3 into the proximal tubule and then effluxed into what is sort of a proto-urine. So again, here are our two tubules. We have a proximal tubule cell, and then we have a blood vessel cell. And for these experiments, we used Huvex. Endothelial cells from kidneys are very, very difficult to obtain. They don't expand well, so it's very hard to get a lot of them. So what we did was we used Huvex, and we used an immature Huvex culture. So if you grow Huvex for more than about 48 hours, they become impermeable. Right, you get a very, very tight barrier. You don't get a lot of leakage or transport out of that vessel. So we used Huvex at 24 hours where they were still very leaky, which is similar to what we see in a kidney endothelial cell. But had enough structural integrity to maintain the patency of that tubule, right? Because if you start having flow through different tubules with different structural characteristics, you start to have fluid dynamics that will push fluid preferentially into one channel or the other. So we used those Huvex as a structural stent, but they were still fenestrated enough to allow solutes to come out of those, out of that tubule. So here's what this looks like after 5 days of PTEC culture, 24 hours of Huvex culture. When we looked for the tubules, they were both fairly confluent, although the Huvex culture was immature. So we had to test this system in order for a system to work. It's actually got to exhibit the characteristics you want it to. The novelty of growing two cell types close to each other is cool, but you actually have to make sure it works and can answer the questions you're asking. So in order for this system to work, our PTEC channel needed to be not leaky, and our endothelial cell or our Huvex culture had to be leaky. So we infused fitzidextran into the blood vessel and saw that fitzidextran escaped from that blood vessel. And after about 2 hours, we got some equilibrium in that interstitial space. But that fitzidextran dye that was in that interstitial space did not leak into our proximal tubule vessel. So that proximal tubule cell vessel was not leaky, but our blood vessel channel was leaky. Again, with the engineering of the chip, it took us about 80 minutes to 2 hours for us to achieve that equilibrium. But we can use this system, we thought, to measure things that were in the blood and then things that came out in the urine. So we also used that inhibitor, probenecid, that inhibits OAT1 and OAT3 to make sure whatever was getting from our blood vessel into our kidney proximal tubule chamber was actually getting through by active transport and not just leakage. So again, we did this ratio of the percent that we put in to the percent that came out. So into the blood vessel, out of the proximal tubule. We did fitzidextran and mannitol and found that almost nothing came out in the proximal tubule. When we put PAH in the system, we knew that that was going to get through and is actively transported into the proximal tubule. And we found that when we added that inhibitor, that we were able to inhibit about 40% of that transport. And that's about what we would expect to see with transport inhibitors in the kidney. It's impossible to block 100% of the transport, and it's impossible to block specific transporters individually. This is just one of the limitations we have when we study this stuff. But a 40% reduction is about what we thought we would see. Again, here's our fitzidextran results, our mannitol results, and our PAH, where we, this is on the top, is what we put in, what came out of that proximal tubule, and this bottom line is what came out when we had that inhibitor on board. So the next step was to take these clearance values, so we would calculate the clearance of what was going into the blood and what came out in the urine, and we could use that to calculate some sort of renal clearance-ish measure. And then we tried to scale that up into a whole human kidney and a whole human person. We estimated the surface area of the proximal tubule in the chip, scaled that up to the size of a proximal tubule in a human, multiply that by a million, because you have a million nephrons in each of your kidneys, and multiplied that by two for two kidneys. And from that, we were able to predict a renal clearance of para-aminohippuric acid, which fortunately has been administered to human beings. So we could compare that to what we see in actual people. And what we found was that the ratio of observed to predicted renal clearance of PAH was 1.96. So we were within twofold of predicting renal clearance of a compound put into a chip and scaling that up into a real person. This was an extremely positive result. In fact, it was so positive that our reviewers were highly suspicious. As always, reviewer number three. Highly suspicious, did not believe us, let us publish it anyway, but was highly suspicious and thought it could just be, you know, lucky. So we took on that challenge, and we tried it with a different drug. So we looked at the clearance of morphine and its metabolite in our liver kidney system. Here on the left is morphine. Again, this is what we put in to the blood vessel side, and we measure what we put into the blood vessel side and what comes out of the blood vessel side, because we're working with plastics and PDMS, and those materials can sometimes adsorb compounds. So we wanted to make sure that what we put in our media reservoir was actually the same as what was coming out of that vessel side, blood vessel side, and that it wasn't all getting absorbed into the plastics. So that's what this dotted line is. And then this solid line on the bottom is showing what came out of the kidney side of that proximal tubule cell, tubule. And so without inhibitor, we saw the translocation of some of the compound from the blood vessel into the proximal tubule. And when we added that inhibitor, we were able to knock out something like 75% of that transport by just blocking the OAT1 and OAT3 transporters. And this was true for both morphine and its metabolite, morphine 6-glucuronide. So again, we did the same process that we did with the para-aminohippurate. We scaled up renal clearance into the area of a human proximal tubule, and then multiplied it by a million, and then multiplied it by two. And what we found was that for morphine and morphine 6-glucuronide, our observed to predicted ratios were 1.08 and 1.24 respectively. So again, our ratios were actually even a little bit better. So we do think that in a very narrow set of circumstances, right? So this is not for all drugs. This is for drugs that are cleared primarily through the kidney via active transport, so not passive diffusion and not filtration, but for drugs that fall within this very narrow set of criteria, something like a kidney on a chip could be useful in predicting drug exposure in humans. So we were very proud of these results, but not content to declare victory. We took this project one step further and decided to use these renal clearance data to try and populate a PBPK model. And a PBPK model is, it's basically like taking the whole body and reducing the body into a set of compartments or boxes, and then connecting those boxes based on kinetic values, both from side A to side B and side B to side A, and then using these multi-compartmental models to try and predict what's happening in the whole body at any given time. So I will say that these PBPK models are, they're physiologically based, but they're not fully physiologic. You can't model every single compartment in the body because that would require you to model every organ, every cell type, every flux rate from one compartment to the next. So we kind of lump some of these compartments together with slow transport and fast transport. And we also have to figure out, where are we sampling and how are we administering the drug. So this was a model that was developed in collaboration with Nino Isoharinen and Dr. Wei-Zhi Huang, who was a PhD student at the time. And they used our morphine renal clearance data that we had scaled from the chip and used it to try and see if they could match what was observed in human subjects. And so when they modeled using their PBPK model, and that's the blue dots, I take it back, that's the red line, and the blue dots are what we actually see in patients. So when we look at morphine total body exposure after a single dose of IV morphine, we see that those blue dots line up quite nicely with our predicted values, which are in red. And we can actually use the data that we derive from a CHIP to understand what happens to morphine in healthy people. But to be honest, understanding what drugs do in healthy people is not actually that interesting, because very healthy people don't often take a lot of drugs. And from a pharmacy perspective, we think a lot about how to use medications in patients with kidney disease. We often don't have a lot of good data. Some of these kidney impairment studies are done with an N of 6, and in patients who don't have a lot of comorbid conditions, so they don't necessarily translate into the general population of people with kidney disease. And we generally have this philosophy with, if you have somebody with kidney disease, start with a low dose and escalate slowly. So this person, you can monitor for side effects and you can monitor for efficacy. And this is a fine philosophy, unless you're that patient and you have pain, or you have a life-threatening infection, or you have cancer, and you don't have time for a pharmacist and a nephrologist to slowly escalate that dose, right? You need to get that dose right, and you need to get it right quickly. So what we decided to do was expand our PBPK model to try and incorporate chronic kidney disease stage 5. So this is the most advanced stage of kidney disease. This is called end-stage kidney disease, or CKD5. And so we incorporated a separate module into this large compartmental model that we called an adaptive kidney disease model. And this is not done by scaling the GFR proportionally. GFR is the common clinical measure for kidney function. It measures glomerular filtration, but not really secretion. So it's not a great way. For some drugs, it's great if your drugs are filtered. If your drugs are secreted, it's not a great way to scale your drugs. So we did not use a directly proportional model. We used something we called an adaptive model, which incorporated things that we know about chronic kidney disease based on animal studies and the limited number of human studies that study the hemodynamics of people with advanced kidney disease. So this is sort of a schematic of how this adaptive model of kidney disease was put together. Again, this was by Weza and Nina. And then we used our data to populate what we think happens in a person with stage 5 kidney disease. And again, in blue dots are the patient-observed data, and in the red line is what we predicted using our adaptive PBPK model. So it's pretty good. We can do better, and we're continuing to refine this model. We're adding on components of uremic solute inhibition, because we know that uremic solutes are uremic toxins, which accumulate in the bodies of people with kidney disease because their kidneys can't excrete some of these biological waste products. We know that some of these uremic toxins can inhibit those transporters like OAT1 and OAT3. So we're continuing to build this model that incorporates transporter inhibition by these uremic solutes. And we're using both patient-derived data and in vitro modeling to try and really refine what's going on in a lot of these patients. But I think, you know, a take-home message for those of you who are involved in clinical service is that dosing drugs in people with kidney disease is very difficult, right? We do the best we can, and I think we're doing actually a pretty good job. But it would be great if we had a little more guidance on, you know, what drug to use and how to dose it in patients with advanced kidney disease. So I'm going to move on to the third project that we've been working on with this kidney on a chip. And this is something I think that's near and dear to the heart of some of the investigators at UCSD, Kat Jamieson. And I just saw her at a space station meeting last week. It was pretty cool. So we're looking at the effects of microgravity on kidney function. And this, again, we're starting with our kidney MPS. And then we had to re-engineer all of our hardware. Because our system is large, it's bulky, it has a lot of tubing, and that does not go on the space station. And then we send it to the space station for two different missions. So our goals were three or fourfold as for these series of experiments. We wanted to look at just basic proximal tubule function. How do those cells look? Are they healthy? Are they alive? Do they polarize appropriately? We also wanted to look at vitamin D metabolism. This was a critical component, right? Remember, those kidneys bioactivate that vitamin D, and that active vitamin D is what helps maintain bone density. And this is a huge problem for people in microgravity. They can lose 1 to 2% of their bone density per month. Compare that to somebody with osteoporosis who's losing 1 to 2% of their bone density per year. So this is an extremely accelerated problem in microgravity. So we wanted to evaluate whether or not the kidney was playing a role in this loss of bone function. We also exposed the kidney to something that was a toxic stimulus. So we exposed it to human serum. And human serum, if protein shows up in your urine, it's generally a sign that something is going wrong. Whether or not it's causing the problem or is a result of the problem, we're not entirely sure. So we wanted to see what would happen if we put protein into that flow in the microphysiological system in microgravity. Are those cells more or less likely to experience negative effects? So those were the goals of our series of experiments. Again, this team was us at the University of Washington, the Kidney Research Institute, and BioServe, which was our implementation partner, which helped us get this experiment off the ground, so to speak. So what we had to do was take our system, which in the lab is about the size of a refrigerator, not like the fancy one with two doors, but the regular one with one door. So we had incubators and a perfusion pneumatic pump that hangs off the side and a bunch of hardware inside that incubator. And we could run 24 chips at once in a big incubator. And then we were told that we would have to run these same 24 chips in a box about the size of your microwave. So we had to take all of the functionality and all of the pieces and the parts that went into that big system and reduce them into the size of something that was very small. This took many, many months of work with our engineering team. And ultimately, they had to hand manufacture something like 2,500 different parts. They tried to contract somebody else to make these parts, but the tolerances were so tight that nobody would do it commercially. So it fell into the hands of the engineer and, of course, the PhD students. But they manufactured these parts. We turned it into a system, which I'm showing you on the right here. This system is about the size of a bread box. It holds 6 chips. Those 6 chips are 1, 2, 3 in each of these housings. The whole system was perfused using a media cassette system that was hooked up to a stepper motor that pushed plungers into these media chambers, which pushed that flow into the chip. And then some of the chambers in that media cassette were actually little Teflon bags that could collect the effluent. So we could collect the effluent and perfuse the system at the same time. On board, the crew members had to pull out this system, swap out these media cassettes, and then just put it back in the system and put it back in the incubator. On board, there are 5 buttons, only 5, and they're big because they're in that glove box where they have those big, hard-to-manage gloves. So we had to run the system off of 5 buttons. We also had temperature control and monitors for action events. The system also had to be vented so that during the launch phase, we could maintain humidity and temperature. But once it went into the incubators on station, we could let the incubator maintain gas content, humidity, and temperature. So we had to have a very adaptable system. Sending something to space, as Dr. Jameson and Muotri will tell you, is not for the faint of heart. It was one of the funnest things I've ever done. We think we want to do it again, but we're not entirely sure. So the results that we had, again, from the first launch, which was CRS-17, it was delayed 5 times. The launch was delayed 5 times. And each time, we were counting down the number of days because we only had so much media in that media cassette. So after 5 delays, we finally launched it on the very last day. Otherwise, we would have had to reboot the entire system. And we launched on May the 4th, which seemed appropriate. Again, when we looked at the effects of ground and flight in response to that serum exposure, what we found was when we had just plain media, there was really no difference between ground and flight. When we put serum in the system, similarly no difference between ground and flight. And this is actually not that surprising, because when you send a crew member to the space station, their kidneys don't stop functioning, right? Any changes you see would be extremely subtle. Right, and or sort of signs of adaptation to an unfamiliar environment. So we didn't see any increase in KIM-1 exposure. And KIM-1 is a marker of kidney injury or cell proliferation. So we didn't see any major die-off of kidney cells, which is, again, what we would have expected. If we had seen a massive die-off in cells, we would know that our model was the one that was wrong. So then we looked at IL-6 secretion. IL-6, as you all know, is a marker of inflammation. And again, with media on ground, we had all the similar ground controls. We didn't see any change between media and serum exposure. But when we put serum in, we saw a difference between ground and flight. So there is some upregulation of IL-6. And what this means, we can't say. Right? Is it because there is some pro-inflammatory state that occurs after a week of microgravity on the International Space Station? Or is this an adaptation for the cells adjusting to an environment that they've never, ever seen before? So we don't know if this is pathology or a reasonable, healthy adaptation. But we do see some, not statistically significant, but we do see a trend towards an increase in IL-6 with serum exposure between ground and flight. And again, this is our study design, seeded the cells in Kennedy, 7 days in microgravity acclimation, and then we had the crew do these media swaps, put everything in cold storage, and send the samples back to us on ground. So this was helpful. This told us that our model worked. It told us that our hardware worked. It told us that something was happening with the cells. We can't really say what it means, but we can say that something's happening with the cells. So our next step was to look at kidney stone response in microgravity. Now, kidney stones are a major concern for NASA. Crew members are at increased risk for kidney stones because of their third spacing all of their fluids, so their total body water is the same, but their intravascular volume is decreased. So they live in a state of pseudo-dehydration. Their bone loss is slowed by exercise, but continues to occur. And that calcium that is resorbed from the bones has to go somewhere. And it goes into the blood where your kidney says, we have too much calcium, we need to start excreting that calcium. But that increases the calcium concentration within the kidney, and that predisposes somebody to kidney stones. Crew members on ISS also eat a high protein diet and a high sodium diet, and these may all be associated with kidney stone formation. And on the left here is a picture of an actual kidney stone. You will notice that it is very, very pointy, and that's why they hurt. Kidney stone can be anywhere from the size of like a crystal of kosher salt. If you are a cook, you knew you have kosher salt. Or it can be the largest one that we've ever heard of was the size of a golf ball. But I will say that the size of the stone is not critical to the pain it can cause. The size of the stone is problematic relative to the size of the tube it's trying to get through. Right, so a very tiny stone trying to get through an even tinier tubule can become a problem. And kidney stones are extremely painful. They cannot be treated at this point on board station or on a Mars mission. It requires a somewhat invasive surgical intervention. And a kidney stone can actually be life-limiting. Right, if it starts to obstruct things and you get renal colic or backup of the urine, it can actually be life-limiting. So it's not just an extremely painful annoyance. It needs to be treated. So NASA is very concerned, both on station and with an eye towards lunar base and Mars mission, that they would like to understand as best they can what predisposes somebody to a kidney stone and what are the sentinel events or the early signs of formation of a pathologic kidney stone. So we decided to send these proximal tubule cells in the chip and expose them to calcium oxalate monohydrate microcrystals. Calcium oxalate is one of the primary components of kidney stones. We synthesized some microcrystals. They're about the size of cornstarch or flour, and we flowed those through our kidney on a chip. And we were looking at signs of inflammation or pathology that are occurring in those tubes, in comparing media with no microcrystals to media with crystals. Now, we had ground controls, but they were not very useful, and we knew this was going to happen because you take these little microcrystals and you put them in a fluid, and then you put that fluid in a media reservoir, and they sink, right? So we couldn't get the crystals into the chip on ground. We could inject them manually with a syringe, but then they would just sink to the bottom of the tubule. Right, so we can't actually do this experiment very well on ground. We use microgravity as a critical part of the experimental design. So what we did was we looked at calcium oxalate monohydrate in flight versus ground, comparing the crystals versus no crystals. And we saw upregulation of 4 genes and downregulation of another 5 genes. And this is based on RNA-seq and looking at differentially expressed genes. And what we saw was that there was something happening with this calcium oxalate monohydrate crystal exposure in flight. Again, we don't have any ground controls. And because I am a pharmacist and I believe in better living through chemistry, we also included a drug arm. And for this, we included potassium citrate. And potassium citrate is a very inexpensive, very well-tolerated drug. It's used to prevent kidney stones in some patients. So we included a potassium citrate arm in our experiment as well. We just co-perfused the microcrystals with potassium citrate. And what we found was that when we included this potassium citrate, only 2 of these genes were differentially expressed compared with the 9 that we saw without the potassium citrate. So this tells us that the effects of potassium citrate may continue to persist even in microgravity, and that maybe this is an appropriate countermeasure for patients or crew members who are at high risk of kidney stone formation. And we don't really worry that much about the NASA astronauts because they're all like superhuman Olympic athletes and, you know, geniuses. We don't worry much about them because they go through such a huge battery of testing before they can become a NASA astronaut. But now that space has become democratized and all you need to go to space is a very deep pocket, we have to start thinking about what happens to normal people when they start to go to space. So, you know, we're going to continue to explore this phenomenon as best we can, but we are not sure quite how we're going to get around this crystal settling problem. Maybe random positioning, maybe some guy talked to me about magnetic levitation, which sounds awesome, but also I don't really understand it. But we'd like to continue this line of work as well, including those countermeasures. Because knowing about a problem is one thing, knowing how to fix it is an entirely different one. So this leads us to the project where we're doing now, which is to look at an extended culture of these kidney on a chip. As I said, chronic kidney disease takes weeks, months, years to develop. These 2-month, 3-month cultures, 1-month, 10-day exposures, probably not going to represent these long-term kidney diseases or these long-term exposures to drugs. So NASA asked us if we could take our kidney on a chip and get it to stay alive for 6 months, because that's actually the average time that a crew member is on station. So with our kidney on a chip and with our kidney organoids that Bino talked to you about, we're trying to see if we can get these things to live for 6 months. Long story short, this is live dead at 6 months. 6-month tubule, green cells are alive, red cells are dead. We're definitely seeing greater than 90% cell viability after 6 months of growth. I do want to point out that these are epithelial cells. So they're like the cells on your skin. They continue to grow and replicate and slough off as those cells die. So the cells that we put in the very beginning of the experiment are not exactly the same cells as the ones that we see in 6 months. These cells are constantly regenerating themselves and forming that tubule. So these cells, epithelial cells, do this, right? They continue to grow, and they continue to look for their neighbors, and when they find their neighbors, they stop growing. So we can get this tubule to remain patent for at least 6 months. When we look at secretion of KIM-1, that injury marker, and IL-6, over time, we did this experiment actually over 0 to 10 months, we found that KIM-1 at baseline was decreasing over this extended culture time. And we don't know why this is. We think it's because our cells are getting quiescent. Cells in the proximal tubule, if you think of them like a muscle, if you sit on your couch for 10 months and then you get up off your couch and try and run a marathon, it's not going to go real well, right? You need to constantly keep training those muscles in order to remain active and healthy. Our cells in that device are not getting a lot of exercise. We don't challenge them with toxins and things that they need to transport and, you know, fluctuating glucose and fluctuating electrolytes. Those cells get pretty lazy. So we think that maybe that's what's happening over the course of 6 months. And maybe we can increase this response if we just sort of make them work out every couple of weeks, give them something to do. The IL-6 also was decreased in the effluent, although not as dramatically. And again, we think this is just loss of stimulus that causes these cells to downregulate pathways that are unnecessary for their current state of being. We challenged them with toxins at 2.5 months, 5 months, and 6 months. And again, we found that this KIM-1 response was diminished. at these different time points still increased. So that response is still there, but it's not as dramatic as we saw when these cells were freshly seeded into these devices. Again, don't know what this means, don't know if this is downregulation or if we can restore that robust response. So we're repeating this experiment with a little bit of more stimulus. So we're gonna infuse a little bit of polymyxin B. This is a nephrotoxic antibiotic. We're gonna infuse a little bit of polymyxin B periodically just to remind the cells that they have a job here. And they need to keep up with their workload so that they can respond if they ever see an actual severe challenge. So we're going to repeat with a little bit of, you know, lower grade exposure for a little extended period of time. We also looked at changes in gene expression over time. And what we're seeing is that with polymyxin exposure at different time points, these are different time points along the x-axis, it's hard to see. Some genes are upregulated and some genes are downregulated. And we looked at genes like hemoxygenase 1 and HMG-CoA reductase, and these are fairly characteristic of epithelial cells, which is good because it tells us that our epithelial cells are not changing their phenotype over time. And the idea that some genes are getting upregulated and some genes are getting downregulated is helpful because it tells us that the cells are not just trying to die, right? They're still able to respond and adapt, and that they're not just, you know, trying to exit the tubule. So this is good. We're going to repeat it again and look at gene changes over time with and without these extended stimuli. And then we're also, we're going to try and figure out how long these cells can go. And so one of our master students saw this gap in one of these tubules. And sometimes these cells sort of delaminate off of that tubule. They detach from that collagen matrix and they tend to slough off and shed. And historically, when we saw this gap, we thought, oh, well, this tubule's toast, you know, and we'd chuck it in the recycle bin. And what he did was he thought, well, these are epithelial cells, right? They grow and grow and grow until they find their neighbors, and then they stop growing, and then they live until they're, you know, they're ready to apoptose, and then they shed, and then they're replaced by other epithelial cells. Why is this gap in the tubule a fatal occurrence? So he said, you know, I'm going to leave them in the incubator, and I want to see what happens. And when he monitored this same tubule, after about 2 weeks and after about a month, what we found was that that tubule repaired itself. So despite this extended growth, these cells are still able to maintain their proliferation and their phenotype and their epithelial phenotype. And Yusuf, who is the student who worked on this project, was kind of, he wasn't a guy that got excited about a lot. Right, he was a pretty like stable dude, and by the end of this experiment, he was calling these cells his little babies, and he wanted them to live for at least a year so that we could have a cupcake party, and we got these cells out to day 390, and after more than a year, it was that collagen matrix in that pink rectangle that was starting to degrade. It wasn't the cells themselves; it was that collagen matrix. So we really do think that we could keep these cells going almost indefinitely if we can provide the right environment. And this is useful for NASA because they would like us to develop a system that can be placed on a moon base or on a Mars mission and can function and be maintained autonomously for an extended period of time until they can be brought back for sample analysis. So we're gonna keep working on this project. Bino also has a 6-month organoid project. He's gotten his organoids to live for at least 6 months with proper cell function. He's maintaining at least a dozen different cell types. So our next step will be to see what happens if we can maybe send these cells to microgravity again. So that was what I had to share with you today. Of course, I need to acknowledge the students and the postdocs and the investigators. The students are the hands and the heart of this work. They are the creative geniuses. We just kind of let them do what they do and try to get out of the way. So we greatly appreciate them. The team, the PI team is Ed Kelly and Jonathan Himmelfarb. Bnode handles our organoid side of things. And again, I'm very grateful for the funding. We've been funded by a variety of organizations because you know what? The kidney chip is a tool, right? We can use that tool in so many different ways. So the FDA is curious and NIGMS is curious and NIDDK is curious. What can we do with a tool like this? So we've been very fortunate to receive funding to continue this work. And at this point, I'll break for any questions.
My name is Cheng Biao Wu. I'm from Department of Neuroscience here at UCLA. I really excited to hear your talk about the chips used to study toxicity. You name it, right? So one of the examples you gave is herb medicine. So my own personal experience, like grew up in China, I know a lot of people use TCM. And I also had the impression when Chinese people are getting old, they all tend to develop kidney problems, right? So what other examples that you use the system to study TCM toxicity other than the example you gave? That's my number one question. My number two question is the multi-chamber system. And is anybody ever used this system to model blood-brain barrier to study neurodegenerative diseases? Thank you.
Okay, great questions. So for the first question, we are using the system, we've used the system to study other sort of environmental toxins and toxins that are consumed. So we use it to study ochratoxin. An ochratoxin is a mycotoxin that comes from a fungus that grows on stored foodstuffs. So things like tea and coffee and rice. And ochratoxin is associated with chronic kidney disease in parts of Southeast Asia and parts of sort of South Asia because of how they grow seasonally. They subsistence farm and they grow things like rice and then they store them. And then this mycotoxin starts to accumulate. So we've looked at ochratoxin A as a potential causative agent for this chronic kidney disease that we observe in some parts of the world. It's not definitive because I think there are also components like clean water and heavy metals and, you know, the kind of fermented foods that people are eating that all contribute to the prevalence of chronic kidney disease in other populations. So it's unlikely that it's a single source. But we try to sort of tackle these one at a time. And we do think that ochratoxin may be one component that is causing this disease in populations outside of the U.S. We were running some samples that we got from Sri Lanka, and our graduate student was looking for controls. And so he was looking at ochratoxin in these foodstuffs, and he also pulled a little bit of water out of Lake Washington, where University of Washington is located. And he actually found a little bit of ochratoxin in the water there. So I think it's ubiquitous. But the doses in some parts of the world are much higher based on their farming and dietary practices. And the second question is the blood-brain barrier, and that is an excellent thing to study, and several groups are looking at blood-brain barrier. The problem with blood-brain barrier is it's a very tricky balance in terms of permeability and tight junction formation and transporter formation. So we are not doing it, but I know that other groups are. And from a pharmacy perspective, it's a really important thing. Right, because some drugs you need to get into the CNS, right? If you're treating things like brain cancers or Alzheimer's, you need to get that past the blood-brain barrier. But for the most part, you don't want things to get through the blood-brain barrier. So I think it's a very challenging organ interface to study, but we're not doing it. Sure.
Have you looked at ADH or aldosterone function in your kidney chips?
We have not. Again, this gets into the whole blood pressure regulation. It could be useful for space flight because they tend to get very hypotensive because of that third spacing, but we haven't delved into the renin aldosterone system. I think that a paper just came out in Science that talked about the origin of renin in the kidney, and I'm not sure that we have the correct cell type to do that.
Mm. Right.
So, you know, please have at it. We'd love to get those results.
So yeah, I'm a stem cell and hematology guy, not a kidney guy. So sorry, I missed at the beginning the source of the cells that you're getting. And more relevant, I imagine people have made these from iPS cells. And you know, then using that system as a genetically tractable model to do, you know, knockouts and knock-ins to identify, you know, more function and mechanisms of kidney disease and such. Is that, you know, so yeah, sort of the source of these and, you know, whether using these for these research models?
Thanks for the question. So we source our cells from primary kidney tissue. And that's either as surgical remnant, discarded surgical remnants for people who are having nephrectomy for renal cell carcinoma. Pathology takes the part that has the cancer, and they let us take the part that is otherwise healthy. We also can get tissue from organ procurement organizations if the organ is not suitable for transplant. So that's where we get our tissue, and then we enzymatically treat it, we filter it, and then we expand only the epithelial cells. So we never go past one or two passages with these proximal tubule epithelial cells. If we do, they start to get a little mesenchymal. So we definitely keep them to two or three passages, but we can cryopreserve them. So we can expand them, put them in the freezer, and then pull them out of the freezer periodically if we need to do more experiments. And this, of course, it would be better if we could do stem cell derived. The problem with stem cell derived proximal tubule epithelial cells is at this point, they tend to maintain a fetal phenotype. So they're not fully mature. And we have Bino, like literally down the hall, who has been trying to help us with this. It would be great to be able to manipulate the genetic background. It would be great to be able to understand over the course of years and decades how genetic changes can affect kidney function. Right now, you know, we don't know how long we can cryopreserve these kidney cells. So if we wanted to repeat an experiment 10 years from now, we might not be able to do that. With stem cell derived, we could really control the genetic background. We could CRISPR things out, we could CRISPR things in, we could look at different disease states, APOL1 genes, polycystic kidney genes, but the fetal phenotype is a bit of a hurdle right now. The transporters that are expressed in these, in the stem cell derived are not exactly the same as what we might expect in an adult kidney cell, but we think it's a great idea. And in terms of industrial development, they would love to have some inexhaustible, stable source of proximal tubule cells because, you know, having to get it from human tissue is definitely a limitation.
I appreciate the excellent data from the liver kidney chip. Beyond the impact of metabolites from the liver, are there other interactions or crosstalk between kidney and liver that you've looked at?
We have not explored it extensively. We expect that there is some liver-kidney crosstalk, also some gut-kidney crosstalk. The limitation between hooking up organs is it's technically very challenging, and we are not entirely sure that it makes sense in all cases, right? We can probably precondition media from one organ and then inject it into the next organ. The direct connection is only really necessary when you have some sort of unstable intermediate, which may be the case with gut-liver or gut-kidney or liver-kidney, as you have these signaling molecules, maybe phosphate, that can cause this interaction. But we haven't really figured out the nuts and bolts of multi-organ systems.
Have you seen anything interesting with microplastics like leaking into the cells from the chip? Because I see lots of plastics going on in there.
We have not. We know that there are now mass spec assays for microplastics. So we could take a look. I think because of the way that the chips are manufactured and the amount of media that we put through them, it's not a huge problem, I think, because of the way that things are molded. But, I mean, now that we have an assay that can look at that, I think that would be great. The other issue is that the volumes are extremely small. So I don't know if we would have enough volume to look for a microplastic or if there was any sort of plastic shedding in the system. We did think about things like plasticizers, though, right? Because in our old system, we ran everything through, you know, 3 or 4 feet of soft plastic tubing. And we did think about, oh, are we getting BPA or other plasticizer leaking into the system? But again, this is all great things to think about, especially when we start thinking about environmental toxins.
It's interesting that you're seeing cells dividing. What are the cells that are dividing, and does that mean you're actually seeing some de-differentiation and then re-differentiation right there?
I am not a developmental biologist, but I don't think we are seeing de-differentiation and re-differentiating because we have a isolated population of epithelial cells. And epithelial cells are able to divide and reproduce and heal injury just like they do on our skin. Without having to go to some progenitor stem cell origin. So I think we're just seeing epithelial cells doing what epithelial cells do.
That was a fascinating talk. Thank you so much. As you know, my interest is in kidney metabolism and particularly proximal tubular cell metabolism. So, and proximal tubules are, at least in vivo, largely oxidative. Have you done any metabolic phenotyping of these cells to see what the metabolism looks like in these proximal tubular epithelial cells?
We're just getting there in terms of looking at fuel sources for the epithelial cells. We know that we have a contrived system, and that our cells are feeding on glucose and not short-chain fatty acids. So we have a bit of an energetic, the cells are alive, but they're not living in their sort of native energetic state. We also know that our cells have a lot of mitochondria, but not like an in vivo kidney cell, which is just packed with mitochondria. I think it's the, Sheena can probably correct me on this, it's one of the cell types with the most mitochondria per cell. Second to heart. It's an extremely metabolic tissue. And our cells do not have that density of mitochondria. And I think, again, it's just due to them not working at top capacity all the time. But, you know, we are thinking of looking at alternate fuel sources, trying to get away from glucose and trying to get into more short-chain fatty acids, just to try and make the system a little more physiologically relevant.
Thank you.
We're coming to the end of the Zoom questions. There seem to be only two left. One of them is, which cells do you think are making IL-6?
It's the proximal tubule cells that are making that IL-6.
And is that known to be a normal
product? Yeah, I think that, yes. So we believe that proximal tubule cell epithelium can produce IL-6. The problem is there is nowhere for that IL-6 to land in this system. So they're producing a cell signaling molecule, but there is no receptor for that IL-6. We think it's proximal tubule. We know that 90% of those cells are proximal in characteristic, and then there's some small population of distal tubule, but there's really no other pericyte, podocyte, any other sort of cell type in the device, which is both a feature and a bug, right?
Right.
Thank you for the talk. It was very interesting. My question is more so about the stuff that's added to the like kidney on a chip, namely like how many levels of more of the recapitulated route of administration, because the levels of digestion that would happen if you take something just like PO versus something that's just intravenously administered, there are different levels of stuff that would be broken down that ultimately does reach the glomerulus. Is it more like an IV type situation with the kidney chip?
In the simplest of devices, we're actually only perfusing what would be glomerular filtrate through the center of that tubule. But computationally, in our PBPK model, we can model drug absorption, first pass metabolism. We can computationally model all of that because a lot of those parameters are fairly well known and can be derived from the physicochemical properties of the drug. So we have done, in Waze's model, he's modeled, you know, sampling site, right? Because that matters too. So he models route of administration, he models sampling site. But it all is super important because when we draw blood levels of drugs, we look at circulating plasma levels. That doesn't necessarily tell us how much of that drug is getting to our tissue of interest. And particularly in the kidney, those kidneys can be exposed to extremely high levels of whatever it is in the body because that urinary filtrate concentrates from, you know, multiple liters a day to whatever it is you're urinating in a day. So that there's that concentrative function that happens in the kidney that can really increase the concentrations of toxins and drugs and metabolites that the kidney actually sees that are way, way higher than what you might see in the blood. Thanks for the question.
Last question. Have any of the astronauts actually gotten kidney stones?
So there was one cosmonaut who came. So the risk seems to be when they come back. So on station, they're okay, but when they come back, they seem to be at higher risk. There was one cosmonaut who I think got a kidney stone while he was on orbit, and then a couple of astronauts who have come back and experienced kidney stones. So, you know, there is some reason to be concerned.
Thanks so much, Kathy, for a really stimulating and forward-looking talk as well, because I'm sure that organs on the chips are going to be the way to look at many kinds of therapies, diseases, and things of that sort.